Your child has so much potential, but your local schools may not be right for them. Check out K-12. K-12 powered schools are accredited tuition-free online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who have chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more. That's k12.com/podcast.
Quinn, Carrie, Ipama.
Guess what? I finished my show in Edinburgh.
You're done. It's a wrap, folks.
It's a wrap, and it's really crazy. This is the first time in literally 4 years, besides the pandemic, 5 years now at this point, we don't know when our next show's going to be.
Do you want to do a rap about rapping?
A rap about rapping?
Mm-hmm.
I rap my show and it feels so weird, but I need a break that's crystal clear. I like traveling and touring the world, but it will be nice to be in a herd. World. What rhymes with world? I lost it. I like traveling and touring the world. Let's just say it's going to be hurled. I am gonna hang in Edinburgh, and you're gonna never guess what I did in the morning. After my show, I stayed up all night. I hung out with my friends, it's all right. I walked up to Arthur's Seat at 5 a.m. and watched the sunrise. It wasn't in my head. I literally,
great.
Thank you. So that's what we did as a celebration. Everybody here, all the clowns and shit. We walked up Arthur's Seat, which you can't see it from my bedroom window, but we walked up Arthur's Seat to watch the sunrise at 5 in the morning.
Wow.
It was like being in college again. It was really fucking insane. It was really amazing. I was sweaty. I walked up. And it was amazing. And like I said this after the tour, and I feel this now, but I continue to feel so proud of me and KK for doing our show. I also loved doing my show here in Edinburgh. Could you believe it? I saw a couple of people who listened to our podcast. I got to meet them, which is amazing.
That's so crazy.
So fun.
Crazy.
It was really wild. Somebody was like, actually, they reached out, and I have to respond to them because I'm not good at that. But they reached out and they're like, hey, I listen to Truly Darkly Creepily. Come to our pastry. But we're not in that area. But I just really loved it. And the show went really well. The festival here is just a lot of ups and downs, but it went really well. And we had a great time. And one of the funny parts, and I'll tell you this story because I think you'll appreciate it, was we were at one of the artist bars one night, and I'm like meeting people, right? And I met this guy, and he was like, oh yeah, I'm a reviewer. And he introduced himself and the publication in which he wrote for. And I was like, oh, you've seen our show. And he's like, I have. And I was like, you didn't like our show. And he was like, mm-hmm. He gave us one of the worst reviews.
That's so awkward.
You for him,
like our show.
For him, it was like, what are you doing hanging out at the fucking artist bar? And here's what killed me the most. What killed me the most about the review of his show, because listen, I get it. It's not for him. He's probably not a fan of chick flicks. Okay. What killed me the most is that in the review, he said to our male collaborator, at least he knows what he's doing.
Oh.
To me... Wow. I'm like, actually, okay. Like, if you have like genuine criticism, okay. Okay. But don't criticize us and then give credit to our male collaborator about a show about chick flicks that also comments often about how men don't know a female experience. Like, you've seen our show.
Wow, 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 wow.
Like,
wow. Yeah,
totally out of place, and also like beyond, like, felt really offensive. It felt
so
like
that was the whole conversation. I just really want the conversation to be longer.
Oh, I
you
think
didn't
I
like our show.
No, I was like,
no,
oh,
I
you
didn't.
No, I don't think he said I didn't. He just like kind of nodded because I was like, you did. I was like, you saw our show, didn't you? And he's like, I did. And I was like, yeah, you hated it. And I think I saw a little red, and I was trying to do the thing of like killing him with kindness a little bit, and also being like, fuck you, dude. Like, fuck you. And he was awkward. And I'm like, but like, again, you're like hanging out at an artist bar where like you're gonna run into people doing shows that you've reviewed poorly. Like, again, and I want to be clear, this is going to be a brag, not a humble brag. It's a brag. We have gotten very few negative reviews on the show. Very few. In fact, I can count them on two fingers. And the fact is, and that's, you know, whatever. That being said, weird, weird, felt bad. But I don't want, I do want to end that, which is to say, I was really proud of us. We had a great festival. We sold out all of our merch.
Oh, nice.
So I'm sorry, I can't come home with the t-shirt for you. Just letting you know, you're not getting a t-shirt. But we sold out all of our merch, which was really cool because people really seemed enthusiastic about it. And then also we hiked to the top of, like, so we stayed up all night. So we ended our show at like 10:30, packed up at 11, hiked the mountain, stayed up until 5 a.m. I ended up going to sleep at 8:30 in the morning yesterday.
Wow, you wild card.
Can you believe it? I'm basically on New York time now, so that's great.
I wanted to talk to you about the shipping container show.
yes.
So can I preface it by saying this little pellet of information for the readers, which was that then, okay, what I want to tell you is that we were going to go to Denver, and what happened was our flight was delayed an hour, and we're at home, our bags are packed. We find out it's delayed an hour in time to change our cab. So we change our cab and we tell the kids. And then it gets delayed an hour again. So we call the cab again and they send Matt a thing that's like, do you want to change flights? Look at your options. And he like goes to look at the options, but he hit the button twice or something. Basically, he booked us on a flight 2 days later by hitting buttons on his phone.
Wait.
And it
wait,
didn't
so
do
was
a thing where it was like confirm. It was like
the cab through Del or through your flight. How did your cab?
No, I'm saying like we called the cab. We just keep like calling our taxi and being like, oh, I'm just trying to paint you a picture of the fact that my family is packed in a taxi's on the way to get us. And we changed our flight by accident to 2 days later. So at first I have like a total breakdown where I'm like, what the fuck? This is crazy. This is so stressful. Like the kids think we're leaving. I think we're leaving. And now we're just here two more days. This is nuts. But the weather was really bad in New York at the time, and they kept delaying the flight. So what ended up happening is that the flight got delayed again and again and again and again and then canceled. So it was totally great that Matt had rebooked us, because this had happened to a lot of people for a lot of flights, and it was suddenly hard to get a ticket out. So we were actually very lucky that we had a flight in 2 days, because some people were like, whoa, even those flights are full. So we stay here. We fly 2 days later, and the whole thing was that I had booked Matt and I a date, and in my head, we've already spent two nights in Denver, and then my parents are going to watch the kids, and we're going to go to dinner and this cool theater experience. Mm-hmm. And the theater experience was showing up to these three shipping containers that have plays completely in blackness that are like 15 minutes inside. And you can buy what was called like a cycle or something, so you pay less, but you get to see all three. That's what I did. So we're like, this is a little weird because now we're landing in Denver.
Bye.
Putting our stuff in the bedroom and being like, remember Denver, you guys? Remember your grandparents? Bye. And that was like not ideal, but I was like, it's booked. So here we go. So we pop the kids in the place and we get in the car and we go drive to this show that we're going to see. And we get there and the guy, the gate is closed to this little sort of field yard that the three shipping containers are in. And the guy says, we're not letting people in right now. If you have tickets, we canceled the first showing. And I was like, why? And he's like, there's lightning. We can't put you in a metal shipping container while there's lightning. And I was like, I agree. So I'm laughing so hard. And we're like, is the other two shows going to be canceled? And he's like, I don't know. Stick around. So it was like, we went to a bar next door, which ended up being very cute and fun, where you like have money on a card. And you can go up to the taps, scan the card, fill your beer just a little if you want, or a lot, but it like keeps track for you. So you can try like a million different beers.
That's so fun.
It's so fun. It was really, really cool. So we're doing that. We're drinking beer and having a good time. But I was basically like, Matt, oh, this is what happened. So we're drinking. My phone rings. And I'm like, this number keeps calling me. And I don't pick up to unknown numbers, but they keep calling. And it's the restaurant that we had reservations at. And they're like, hey, you can't come at 8. And I'm like, why? And they're like, they're doing really crazy construction outside the restaurant. And the construction people just told us they're going to shut off our water at 8. You can still come tonight, but you need to get your order in by 8 because they're going to shut everything. Like, you need to come at 7:30 if you want to come. And I start laughing so hard. And I turn to Matt and I go, like, I don't believe in God, but if there is a God, they don't want us going on a date. They don't want us going on a date. They tried. The first it was the flight. Then the show is like canceled. Then the dinner is canceled. And it's all these unrelated things. Like, it was so bananas. Everything ended up fine. We got to go see 2 of the 3 shows. Not the one you got to see. We got to see Coma and we got to see Seance were the names of our 2 experiences. And they are super weird. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was completely unlike anything I'd ever experienced to walk into this pitch blackness and they have you put on these headphones and say, make sure they're oriented right, left. And then you sit in the darkness and there's some things that move, like in Seance, our hands are on a table the whole show. And so much of the drama is done by, you know, hearing footsteps and feeling like something's behind you, hearing something get closer and farther, feeling the table shake. Lots of really fun effects that enriched it. And then Coma, you were lying in bunk beds and it was like a post-apocalyptic feeling. And they have you take a pill at the beginning.
What?
Yes. And they're like, you don't have to if you don't want to. But in the spirit of community, we suggest you take it. And you can chew it or you can swallow it. And like, there's a pill on like a little spoon coming out of the wall next to your bunk. And you can take the pill or not.
Did you
and
take
then you
it?
Have this experience. Of course they took it. I'm such a
Was it sweet? Did you chew
joiner.
It?
I swallowed it. Matt chewed it and said it was an empty capsule.
That's great.
Yeah. So it
That's
was
so fun.
Oh, and then we get to the restaurant and you'll die. The construction, it's like a big, beautiful window that we're sat in. And the construction guys, soon as we sit down, turn on the construction light pointed at the window, like blinding, like, but hilarious. Like I died laughing. Like it could not have been. We were like in a TV show at that point. And the waitresses just came around and shut all the curtains. So the restaurant was just in darkness. But I was like, this is so funny.
Well, I'm really glad you survived the date. You missed flight. Flight was pretty cool.
Flight was the one we missed. And then I made Carrie go see it because I heard it was in Edinburgh. And I was like, at least she can see it.
Yes. And I could tell you about it. It was, I mean, it's really cool. You walk into a shipping container and it looks like a plane. And they give you like a seat to sit in. Somebody was sitting in my seat in Tippecanoe. And I said, well, I'll just take the other one. And he was like, I didn't think they were for real. And I was like, that's okay. So I went into my seat and I sat down and they do the left, right. And in it, they were like, the lights will come after they do this. And they're going to have 15 minutes or they're going to do a first 5 minutes. And the next first time the lights come on, you can leave. They gave you an option to leave. Did they do that for you? I think they did that for us because the flight was, I think, a bit scarier. I think it was like a little bit because it's hard to describe. But what was very cool about it is that you have your ear, your headphones in, and the audio design, the sound design of it was incredible. Where it felt like someone was genuinely whispering in your ear.
Yeah.
It was really, really fucking cool and scary. And so the premise is the flight splits into an alternate reality. And it's a little bit like Schrodinger's cat. You know, like the cat is alive and the cat is dead in this box. And the only way to prove it. But like when the box is closed, isn't that what Schrodinger's cat is? Is like.
Yep.
The cat is equal parts dead, it's equal parts alive.
Yes.
And so the idea is like your plane
coexist. Yeah.
And so the idea is your plane, it's the same thing. It's like every plane lands, every plane crashes. Like you don't know. And so there were rustling against my legs. And at one point, they had the lights. It was in pitch blackness. And the lights kind of came on. And they had opened a curtain that was clearly a mirror, so it looked like there was another side of the plane, which was very cool. But it was the whispering. It was like, but it, there was one moment that was incredibly loud in a way that felt very uncomfortable. And so I took, like, I jumped and I took my headphones off and I could hear it, but I was like, I had to, because it was too loud for me. Yeah. But it was very cool. I did not do arcade because I think also too, being in Edinburgh, it's like, if you're going to be spending time seeing a show, it feels like you should see a show with people in it and support the people in shows. Sure. So we saw one sort of like ambient, and I didn't see arcade, but I would absolutely go back to these. Also, it was £12 for a ticket. I don't know how much it was to do an experience for you.
Yeah, I don't remember because I bought that pack.
But I was like, there was something about £12 of like doing this thing that was every half hour all day. And I was like, wait a minute, this is the same amount for an hour show that's doing one a day. And I just felt a little bit like I should see live shows because I can probably see this shipping container.
I agree,
container
but also you,
another time.
You, I think that the point was to see one, because really just like getting the experience of going, what is this weird
Yeah. Did you prefer Coma or Seance? I think Seance was actually in Edinburgh last year, but I didn't know what it was, so I didn't do it. Mm. But yeah, I mean,
well,
it was very cool.
I'm glad you tried one because it's so unusual.
Yeah, the sound design of it was stunning. And also, like, the fact that the shipping container looked like a plane was really fun. Really, really fun.
Should we do some stories?
By the way, you're listening to Truly.
Darkly.
Creeply. And we have some, and I'm Carrie Smith Ipama, and we have some Patreons to thank.
Oh, yeah. First, we got a Patreon subscriber. This is so nice. Her name's Maddie. And she was like, don't shout me out. Shout out my friend, Courtney. And the things we know, about Courtney are that she has a dog named Cheddar and that she's engaged to Joe.
I love that. Okay, let me think really fast. Courtney, you are a blessing to our lives. You have a dog named Cheddar. You're going to be a wife to Joe. Joe, you're so cool, but I don't want to talk about Joe. I want to talk about Maddie, because Maddie is friends with Courtney and a great friend. You two are pals till the very fucking end. Courtney and Maddie, you are a joy to me. So let's hang out and drink drinks by the sea.
Whoa, on fire. Nothing to add. No notes. That was sensational.
I mean, listen, hey, Courtney, you're lucky to have a friend like Maddie. Maddie, it sounds like you're really lucky to have a friend like Courtney. And Joe, happier there. Cheddar, though, great dog name. Dog name. And also, engaged, I don't want to discredit. I just love female friendship, obviously. But I got to say, best wishes, mazel tov. You know, viva la France. So I think have a wonderful wedding and dance your face off. That's what I want you to do.
Slay.
Anyone else?
Let's thank Damaris.
Wait, can we just
Damaris.
Damaris, are you a Greek god? Damaris, you are so funny. You are...
Damaris, it sounds like Daenerys Targaryen. Are you the queen of dragons or just true crime? Damaris, let's get on the Ferris wheel and know each other better. We're going round and round. It doesn't go up and down, Damaris. We care-us. We really, really care-us about us. We care about us. But also
and
you.
And you, Damaris. Damaris, what a beautiful name. Do people call you Demi?
Ooh, love.
Or do they call you Eris? Are you a Demi Eris?
Ooh! That's a really pretty name.
That's a beautiful name.
Okay. Let's do one more. Let's do Mel, because they are not going to hell. Let's do Mel.
Mel,
I bet
you
smell
are a dream
really
to tell.
Great.
Yeah, you smell great, and you are the not late to the party. You're here on time now to hang us with us. We're gonna have a cow of a whale of a good time. Gonna name all the animals. Orcas,
we
whales,
know that you
chickens.
Love animals, Mel. We know that. We just feel it in
we
our
just
bones.
Feel
Mel,
it in our bones.
You fell straight into our hearts and we love you so much. And Mel, we're gonna sell you so much stories on Patreon.
Yes, yes. Mel, okay, Mel, Damaris, Maddie, Courtney, Joe. I mean, really, really good work today, you guys. But, you know, love you guys. Thank you so much for joining Patreon.
Love you to the end.
Love you to the damn end. I would love to tell a story. I got this from Wikipedia.
Why the fuck not?
Yeah, sure. I just want to make sure my mic is working.
Testing.
Testing. We're good. I'm going to tell a story. Like, this is our game.
To hear it. Oh, you're going to do it like, okay, it's flight.
This is
you're on a plane.
You're on a plane.
Alternate reality.
I got this information from Wikipedia. Big Think, the crime report. Let's go. We're going to look at Dan White. Dan White has a name that's so boring. It's just a weird name. And
oh my God,
the color
wait,
white.
But wait, stop. I have to tell you something because you said that. You're going to die at this story. So my best friend Lucy is married to a guy named Tony Nguyen. Like a, you know the name Nguyen, like N-G-Y-U-N?
Yeah.
Very common. It's a very common name.
I don't know how to say it, though.
I think it's Nguyen, but it's okay, very common. And the name Tony Nguyen is also very common. And Lucy had gone on like several dates with him, like maybe only been dating him a month. And then she was at her grandma's house and saw on her grandma's table a check made out to Tony Nguyen. And she was like, I have
my
to
grandma's
know,
paying.
Are you paying somebody to go out with me? But it was like her gardener. It was totally unrelated. But like
that's
to
really
only
good.
Have gone out with the guy a few times and then to see that check at grandma's.
I love that, don't you?
I
really love that. Really,
she was
really
like,
love that.
Oh my God. He's getting paid to date me.
And then
but
he's going to actually fall in love with her. And that's actually a fun chick flick.
That was the rom-com.
That was it. I think we've all seen that before. It's called Love Don't Cost a Thing or something. Anyway, so Dan White, he's born in Long Beach, California in 1946. He's from a working class Irish American family. Just giving a quick biography of this guy, Dan White. He joins the army in 1965. Not a great time to join the army. Looks like he's going to Vietnam. He serves in Vietnam, I think, 2 years, and then he is honorably discharged in 1971. After this, he goes on to serve as a security guard in Anchorage, Alaska, and then he goes to San Francisco, where he joins the San Francisco Police Department. He then quits the police force after he reports another officer for beating a handcuffed subject. Not a good look, guys. So
no,
he quits
sir.
The force, and he's like, you know what? I'm going to join the fire department. Okay, he joins the fire department. And while he's at the fire department, he rescues a woman and her baby from a 7th-floor apartment. And when the newspaper reports on it, he's also like an attractive man. The city dubs him an all-American boy.
All-American boy. I mean,
he like serves.
Okay.
He like was in the military.
Yeah,
he served.
I just, like
it's. Listen, it's not going to go well for Dan. I'm going to tell you right now, and it's not going to go well because Dan's not going to be the good guy in this story. But I want to give you
no all-American boys are.
Somebody
tells
guys.
You they're an all-American boy, run.
American boy. Isn't that a Kanye West feature? So also indicative. Not a good one. Got to get out of there. It's 1977, and he takes his turn at politics. He is elected to the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. And so what I think the Board of Supervisors is, they work in City Hall, and they are they have constituents in their districts, right? And so his district, I think, is like a lot of like working class family types. And he is a Democrat, and part of what he is representing for his constituents is that he supports the police and firefighting unions. I think a lot of them are in his district. And at the same time, during this time in 1977, the gay community in San Francisco is growing more and more and more visible, and rightfully so, right? San Francisco is a bastion at this time, and it still is. However, Dan White's district is growing more hostile towards the gay community, and he represents them. But I think what we can surmise from this is that he's like all for home and family, and his constituents are, you know, and he represents as going like he's against homosexuality, pot smoking, and cynics, of which I fall into the later category, as I sometimes smoke pot and I am a cynic. But his record on bills that oppose the gay community are a little confusing, right? Like, listen, we know he's against and he's not fighting for them, right? But we do know that he opposed the initiative to ban gay folks from working in public schools. So that's good, right? He's like, I'm not going to sign on to that bill.
Right.
That's banning gay folks. However, he also voted against a ban on discrimination, which is confusing after the first part. So he voted, there was a ban on discrimination for gays in housing and unemployment, right? And he voted against that so that they could be discriminated against. So not good. Not good, Dan White.
Maybe he was confused. It sounds like he was.
Sounds like he's a little confused. But I think at this time, now, at around this time, Harvey Milk is coming into politics. And it's a really huge, because Harvey Milk is the first openly gay office holder in California history. And while the two certainly disagreed on a lot of things, they worked together closely. And it seemed like Dan was almost like, sort of like some Republicans now, where they're like, I don't like what this all means. But when I meet one person I like, it's kind of the exception to the rule. Do you know those people?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? Like, people can justify because they have an interpersonal relationship. But when it comes to, like, the broader sort of, like, the broader look of things, they're like, I don't know if I'm comfortable with it. So, in fact, it's interesting because Harvey Milk, who we know, is an incredible advocate in the San Francisco political community for gay folks. And he was just, like, a fucking incredible dude, right? Harvey Milk was actually one of three people from City Hall that Dan worked with that he invited to his newborn's baptism after the 1977 election, which I think I think that's an important anecdote to say that of all the people he worked with, three were invited and one of them was Harvey Milk, the first outwardly gay person elected in California. Interestingly enough, Dan White also persuaded Dianne Feinstein to appoint Harvey Milk to chairman of the Streets and Transportation Committee. Because around this time, Dianne Feinstein, I think, was the president of the supervisors. I don't know what her exact title was, but Dan White advocated for Harvey Milk to be the head, to be the chairman of one of the committees. It is April 1978. The Catholic Church, I actually didn't know this. This was blew my mind. In April of 1978, the Catholic Church proposed a facility in Dan White's district for juvenile offenders who committed crimes like murder, arson, rape, and other crimes that would be operated by Sisters of Good Shepherd. Does that make sense to you? I said a lot there. Okay. This blew my mind because the Roman Catholic Church is like, hey, as if I didn't have enough power, I would like to build a juvenile detention facility in Dan White's district. Right?
Okay. Okay.
What's crazy to me, just as like a sidebar, is that the church is building a juvenile offender facility that's going to be operated by nuns.
That's so old school somehow.
It's 1978, so I would say at this point it's pretty old school, but also like, why is the Catholic Church going into a like, what's going on? I mean, I guess like there's a lot of churches, but like what, that felt weird to me, just as like an interesting anecdote. Now, White opposes the facility in his community because I don't think it's like a great sell to be like, hey guys, the church wants to build something. It's going to house these juvenile kids who committed murder, arson, rape, and other crimes. You in? I don't think it's a popular thing. But Harvey Milk supported this facility. And I guess this was beginning to cause a rift between Dan and Harvey. November 10th, 1978, so not that long after, about a half a year after this facility and this disagreement between Harvey and Dan resigns publicly as a supervisor, right? He resigns his position. He says he wasn't satisfied with the corrupt practices of the San Francisco politics. And he also, in addition, he wasn't making enough money. He was having a hard time earning a living without a police or firefighter salary that he could not even do because he was a supervisor, right? So he quits, he resigns. He also, as an anecdote that I saw, he opened a baked potato stand and it wasn't making him any money.
A baked potato stand, okay.
Can I tell you, there's actually a great baked potato stand here in the UK and they make really good jacket potatoes.
Oh, nice.
It's really good. It's interesting. That anecdote was like, he couldn't be a firefighter or police officer, and his baked potato stand wasn't making any money. So it's 4 days later, November 14th, and he's like, you know what? I actually changed my mind. I don't want to resign. And his supporters lobbied him to seek reappointment through Mayor George Moscone. And while the mayor initially heard his desire to be appointed and was like, okay, maybe I'll reappoint you, he later refused at the urging of Harvey Milk and others. So, like, basically, if that doesn't make sense, here's what it is. He went and he's like, I resign. This politics are corrupt. I can't make enough money. My baked potato stand is not working. And then 4 days later, he's like, I changed my mind. I actually would like to come back, and I'm going to talk to the mayor who could reappoint me. And the mayor's like, you know what? You're making a good case. Mayor George Moscone. I love your baked potatoes. Let me think about it. But it's looking good. And then the mayor, like, kind of goes and talks to the people that have not resigned publicly the last 4 days and called San Francisco politics corrupt. And they didn't have baked potato stands. And they're like, listen, I don't think this is a good idea. He doesn't seem well. I don't think you should reappoint him. And so the mayor's like, you know what? I'm going to go with the people that didn't resign. It is November 27th, 1978. And Dan is not doing great because he's not been reappointed. He's resigned. And he decides to go to City Hall. Now, he doesn't go to City Hall in the way you would expect, which is through a door.
Yeah. Go on.
He goes through the basement window. Now,
you're right. I wasn't expecting that.
You weren't expecting that. Now, people say that this was like, there's been people who in the trial that followed that said that this was a common practice where people could get in faster if they went through a window. What's really happening though is that there is a new metal detector installed at the door, and Dan would not do great going through that metal detector. Because that guy has a revolver on him and 10 rounds of ammunition. He climbs through the window and he goes to Moscone's office, the mayor, and he begs to be reinstated as supervisor. Mayor Moscone is like, the answer is no. Dan White pulls out his gun and he shoots him in the shoulder, in his chest, and twice in the head. After this, Dan goes to Harvey Milk's office. He shoots him 5 times, and the 2 final shots are touching Harvey's head. After he assassinates 2 of his colleagues, 2 people that he worked closely with, including a man he invited to his child's baptism, he flees, and eventually he surrenders to the police at the Northern Police Station, where he was once a police officer. It is revealed later that in addition to Moscone and Milk, he also intended to kill California Assembly Speaker Willie Brown and Supervisor Carol Ruth Silver, who he also blamed for lobbying Moscone not to reappoint him. They have his taped confession of him saying, I just shot him. What's interesting politically that I want to make note of is Dianne Feinstein. You know who Dianne Feinstein is, right? She was one of the longest serving senators from California. She was the president of the supervisor, but when Moscone died, she succeeded him as the mayor and was the first woman to serve in that position. So what kind of forayed her into sort of upper levels of political service was this assassination. He was put on trial, and his defense would argue that it was not premeditated murder because at the time of the murders, he was at diminished capacity due to depression, that he was not capable of premeditated murder, so he was not legally guilty of first-degree murder because of his mental.
Okay.
Which is, I think, bullshit. That's my thought. That is my... He went through a window, I think, to avoid metal detectors. However, at this trial, people are saying, you know, people in City Hall just went through windows. feels like the security is fucked in that case. But what's really interesting, and this is where the media sort of grabbed hold of this defense, and I'm bearing the lead. Do you remember a couple weeks ago when I told you the story of Elena Steinberg, known as the Jewish American princess?
I do.
And the prosecutor brought forth this forensic psychiatrist, Martin Blinder, to testify that because she was nagging about money and that she only put out once a week, that he could argue battered husband syndrome and this guy got off fully.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So in this case with Dan White, they are using his depression and his anxiety of like his heightened state that he couldn't do premeditated murder. And the expert witness that they called to testify for the defense is none other than Martin Blinder. He sought to prove Dan's depression. Now, the things that he used was that he quit his job. He like acted erratically to the moments leading up to this murder. Okay. He quit his job. He shunned his wife. He dressed sloppily. And one of the things he also attributes was that Dan White went from eating very healthily, exercising, and then he started consuming sugary food and drinks.
This is the argument is diet.
The argument is that he started, yes, that. And now it's important to note that there is what people now refer to as the Twinkie defense. Have you heard about the Twinkie defense?
No. But okay. I think I understand it.
Yes. The
it's
newspapers.
Just basically food made you crazy. You had a bad diet.
So, yes. Like I mean, the Twinkie defense is that.
The food Kellogg, ideology.
Yes. Okay. The Twinkie defense is that you ate too much sugar and you were eating unhealthily and you became erratic and acted outside of yourself in some way. Now, it's important to note that he mentioned Twinkie once in his testimony, and the newspapers at the time, which obviously this case was highly publicized, two public figures were assassinated, including Harvey Milk, who was a massive celebrity in the political world, especially in San Francisco. And so the trial was reported on very strongly, very diligently. And so when he mentioned Twinkies, the newspapers took the Twinkie defense and said, they're trying to say this guy committed murder because he was eating too much sugary foods. Now, what was actually happening is that Martin Blinder was using the sort of Twinkie anecdote to highlight how depressed he really was, which I don't know if it's strong on either account. So the Twinkie defense feels like it was a more of a media sensationalist idea or term, because it's not a recognized legal defense, right? It's a term that's coined by reporters. Like, you can't go into the court and say, hey, I'm going to do the Twinkie defense. Because it's not, you know, it's a derisive label for an improbably legal defense. That's sort of, it's not actually the legal defense. But this is where it became, this is where it gained notoriety. And it was heavily discussed in pop culture in a lot of ways. So Blinder, I'm just going to give you a quote as to what he said in court. There is a substantial body of evidence that is, do I want to read that yet? No. What I'm going to say is this, is that White's attorneys did not argue that Twinkies or sugary foods were the cause of his actions, but rather they were trying to prove that they were symptoms for his underlying depression. Now, there is some anecdotal research to say when people eat healthily, they have better emotional outcomes and they act probably a little bit nicer, which is not surprising to me. You know, like it's like when you eat something, it's like eating a bunch of candy versus eating like a nice salad and, you know, food, you're probably going to feel different, and that affects your emotional state. And so there is some anecdotal research, which is to say that like healthy food was given to inmates and they found that aggression, infractions, and antisocial behavior were reduced when people were eating a healthier diet. There were also various studies that demonstrated that consuming nutritious whole foods rather than processed high fat, high sugar foods improved mental health, mood, and academic outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
And all of those will factor into someone's likelihood of committing a crime. So while like, it just was, I had to look up the Twinkie defense because I was like, what is this? I need to find out more. And I think while I understand and can totally say a person is going to perform better when they have nutrient dense food, it certainly is not justification for murder. Right? Blinder stated, there is a substantial body of evidence that in susceptible individuals, large quantities of what we call junk food, high sugar content food with lots of preservatives, can precipitate antisocial and even violent behavior. There have been some studies, for example, where they have taken so-called career criminals and taken them off their junk food and put them on milk and meat and potatoes, and their criminal records immediately evaporate. Now, Martin Blinder, this guy loves to take like a kernel of something and just fucking run, is what I've found with him. A woman nags, a husband can kill. You give someone a salad, their violence disappears. I just don't believe that to have that causation, to have that effect. Or what is that? That cause and effect does not compute to me, right? So while they're in trial, they're playing this, and I'm going to say it, I really do think homophobia also plays a role in the trial, in this jury, because, like I said, in addition to this, like, Twinkie defense that I will call colloquially, jurors hear his, Dan White's confession, where he is crying, where he is incredibly distraught. Jurors are weeping, and they say they hear a man who's been pushed beyond his endurance. Also, the San Francisco Police Department, if you remember, Dan White was a part of, and they do protect their own. They said that, you know, people do carry weapons, and extra and carrying extra ammo is a habit just police officers have. The jury goes to deliberate. Dan White is found guilty on manslaughter, not on first degree premeditated murder, just manslaughter. And he is sentenced to only 7 years in prison. This is the lightest possible sentence for his actions. After this is happening, the San Francisco gay community is absolutely outraged, and rightfully so.
Of course,
this is a man who killed one of their own, a man who was fighting for them and advocating for them in City Hall, a man who broke glass ceilings and barriers and did it all with love and compassion and advocacy. It sparked the city's White Night riots. This was the most violent reaction by gay Americans since the 1969 Stonewall riots, which started Pride as we know it. The gay community had a long-standing conflict with the San Francisco Police Department. Raise your hand if you're surprised. Oh, no one? Crazy. And White's status as a former police officer intensified that anger, because they see again, once again, justice is not being made. A man point-blank kills Harvey Milk, puts two gun, like, they again, they talk about the last two shots in Harvey Milk's head were touching his skull. Point-blank murder and execution. And the police are defending Dan White and justifying why he was carrying 10 rounds of ammo. The march started as peaceful, and it escalated at City Hall. There were damages done to City Hall. There were many injuries. After it's broken up, the police then made a retaliatory raid on a gay bar in San Francisco's Castro District. Patrons were beaten by police in riot gear. 24 arrests are made. People are suing the San Francisco Police Department. Gay leaders at the time refused to apologize, and the political power in the gay community increased, which led to the actual election of Mayor Dianne Feinstein. So she succeeded Moscone, so she wasn't elected, but because of this engaged political force of the gay community in San Francisco, she was elected to a full term the following November. After her election, she appointed a pro-gay chief of police, and this was said to increase recruitment of gay individuals in the police force, which could possibly help ease tensions between the gay community and the police department. Mm-hmm. Dan Wright, as you recall, was serving 7 years. However, he only served 5 for murdering 2 people. For murdering 2 people. He was paroled in 1984, and they did not think that him serving his parole in San Francisco would be smart. In fact, it would probably be dangerous. So they moved him to LA because they feared he might be murdered in retaliation. After his parole was finished in LA, the mayor of LA was like, we don't want him. The mayor in San Francisco was like, we don't want him either. Like, this is not someone we want around our community. He eventually moved back to San Francisco and lived with his wife and kids. Less than 2 years later, in 1985, he killed himself. Obviously, this story is well known and has been depicted in Milk, has been in documentaries, and something I actually found out, that song I Fought the Law and the Law Won,
Law Won
by the Dead Kennedys.
No, never heard it.
Oh my God. It was in a show that we were in together. Holy shit.
I'm like, Carrie, come on.
Carrie, hi. That song is actually written as if from Dan White's perspective. I wanted to highlight, obviously, I think we've knew that Harvey Milk was assassinated, but I did want to talk about the Twinkie defense that became famous from that trial. And that's the story of Dan White, the Twinkie defense.
I had not remembered most of that, so I'm really glad you told it.
Good. I mean, yeah, Twinkie defense. I just feel like I shouldn't tell you that because I feel like you're going to be like, Tekoa can't have any Twinkies.
Yeah, lest he do a murder. I am going to tell you a story now, the story of Heather Stroob. And I got this from AJC, Oxygen, NBC, and most notably Dateline.
Mm.
This story happens, the main part of the story is going to happen on April 26, 2009, which is a Sunday. It's just before 6 p.m. We're in Snell, Georgia, and Heather Stroob is pulling into a parking lot. She is picking up her son because she has joint custody with her ex of their toddler. But someone is in this parking lot and a single gunshot is heard. And suddenly a bunch of phone calls are going to police saying that we just heard a shot. We just saw a woman slump down. We saw a perp walk away from the scene. This is like a parking lot near a mall and a hotel. It's like, it's very, very public where this is happening. Yeah. And people are saying this person just walked up to the car and shot this woman. And they're calling, they're saying, like, this is where the perp is walking. I see them walking away. Like, it's very crazy, the level of witnesses of this crime. Mm-hmm. And when the officer shows up, this woman, Heather, has died of her wounds. She's dead on the ground because she was outside the car when it happened. And she's got her little kid, her two-year-old, is in the car seat, unharmed, but only physically, you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah,
this baby saw their mom get killed. It's just incredibly heartbreaking. They don't know who Heather is at the moment, so they look in the car and they find an address on an envelope of a birthday card, and it's her parents, and they call them, and they're driving at the time, and the parents pull over and are just can't speak, you know, they're horrified, and they start to call some of Heather's friends and loved ones to let them know. One of Heather's best friends had just talked to her when she gets the call, and she's just like, turns on the news, sees Heather's car like there in the lot, sees the blood on the ground. It's just, for everybody, this is surreal. Who would want to kill Heather?
Mm-hmm.
And there's no evidence to support that this murder was related to a robbery. Like, her wallet's there. Nothing's taken. It doesn't seem like somebody was trying to take the car with a baby in a car seat. Like, they can't figure this out. And there's no physical evidence left behind. There's no casing for the bullet. So they're like, okay, a revolver could have been the weapon because it wouldn't have left a casing. They look for blood at the scene. The only blood at the scene is Heather's. They bring in dogs to try to track where the perpetrator might have gone. And they're kind of alerting on a nearby parking lot that would have been the direction that people saw this person walking in. So it's like, okay, maybe they parked in this parking lot, walked over to the other parking lot, shot Heather, and then left. But why? So the first thing they're going to do is look at her ex, who she had just exchanged the child with, Carson, their baby. So her ex is Steven. They were high school sweethearts and got married right away and had Carson when they were really young. And Steven's mom, Joanna, helps them with Carson because they're two young parents. They're trying to figure out time for each other, time to work, but they don't have a rock solid marriage. Like I said, they're very young. Steven ends up having an affair and she finds out about it and he won't stop the affair. He's now with that person.
Okay, so we have motive.
What's the motive?
Oh, I thought, wait, am I missing it? That like he's having an affair with someone?
He's having an affair, but they're now separated. I would say, sure. Okay, I would say the motive's not the affair. Motive would be custody, maybe?
Yeah. I mean, that he has another life, yeah.
They didn't have, like, a clean separation. I don't think Steven was a very good husband. Obviously, he was having an affair, but also there's some light indications that their fights got a little out of hand. One of the dad, like, her dad gets asked about it, and he's very, like, I don't want to talk about it, but something happened, but I don't want to talk about it. They had, like, tried to stay together. They tried marriage counseling through their church, but they separated. They're bringing in witnesses that are corroborating that there was a child swap taking place, with what they saw, that there was, Heather getting a baby, putting it back in the car seat. But that after that happened, they saw a white male approach the car. They heard a scream. They saw somebody block her from getting in the driver's side door back into her car and like shoot her. They said it seemed like the person was in a disguise. And they're asking them, like, did this person that shot Heather seem like they knew Heather? And some people are like, I totally got the feeling they did. And some people are like, no, it seemed like they were strangers. It's eyewitness accounts. It's like people are just making assumptions. Who knows what they're even based on? Heather had a new boyfriend. His name's Michael. They bring him in. They notice right away that his height and weight match the description of the shooter. But there's no obvious motive. In fact, he seems really into her and into Carson, and their relationship was going really well. They're just like, cannot figure how it could possibly have been this guy. But they're also like, well, he did know where she was going to be. Like, whoever did this to Heather had to know about the baby swap, you know? Right.
Yeah.
They had to, like, the custody swap. They had to know because.
Yeah.
And so, like, who knew? And they're like, well, Steven knew, the ex, Michael knew, the current boyfriend. Like, we don't know who else could have known. They're asking Heather's friends, do you know anybody that has a reason to target her? Was she into anything weird? Drugs? Like, any? They're just trying to broaden the search, but they're like, no. And this friend, Tracy, is like, you know, the only person that might have wanted to do her harm was Steven, was her ex, because they had this horrible divorce. They were fighting over custody. And they're like, but would he shoot her in front of his son? And they're like, I don't know. Maybe. Like, maybe he did it and didn't think about it. I mean, and obviously the friends have a perspective of, like, he was a really bad partner. He cheated on her. He's now together with that woman, Stacy.
I mean, having a violent background is not, is like usually an indicator to escalation.
Not only that, but the friends are saying things like, look, when she would go do these custody swaps, we would make her call us after. We didn't like her having to go see him. We felt nervous about it. Yeah. It was like nasty between them. We didn't like it. They go to Steven's house to tell him. And the weirdest thing happens where they ring the doorbell and Steven's stepdad answers the door and Steven's in the background and they're like, we're looking for Steven. Are you him? And he's like, no, I'm his cousin. And then they find out later that was Steven. And they're like, that was very weird because
that doesn't
no one
look
had even,
good.
No one had even told him Heather died. So no. It was like they bring him in and they're like, what the fuck was that? And he's like, oh, I thought you were there about like a debt that I owed. I just got nervous. And they're like, we're not. We're here because Heather got shot. And he's very upset. He says he has an alibi. He was at a car wash. He was with Stacy. He was hanging out. He drove home that night. They look at like everything he says and it lines up for the most part. But what's more than that is they will later get footage of when he drove away from the child swap and it doesn't line up that he could have driven away and then snuck back. Like it's like we have him in the car leaving. So they're like, it really doesn't seem like it could be Steven. It doesn't mean Steven didn't have anything to do with this, but he's not our trigger man, we don't think.
Yeah. I do love that people are like, don't love having CCTV everywhere. But I got to tell you, it seems good sure also to exonerate people.
Yeah, because
if there was no TV thing of that guy.
Well, CCTV is going to have a major role in this case. So meanwhile, Heather's parents, knowing Heather had a horrible history with Stephen, they don't want Stephen to have custody of Carson. They're hiring an attorney to fight for it. Stephen and Joanna, his mom, are hiring an attorney to fight to have Carson, who this poor baby saw his mother die. I just can't stop thinking about that. They're watching this footage that I told you about. And it doesn't catch the actual shooting, but it catches people like seeing it. Like it shows people like stopping in their tracks nearby. It does. They find a camera angle that does have the shooter leaving the parking, like coming into the parking lot and leaving. Mm-hmm. And they're like, okay, this is what they're wearing. This is what they look like. It's hard to see. It's as grainy as you might imagine. And it's that stop motion thing. But even from the stop motion, you can tell they're not rushing in or out, which is odd. They're like mm-hmm. walking, maybe to not draw attention. They just like walked away after doing it. It's a strange wide gait that they have that's rather stiff. So this is all they really know. Then they're asking Stacy, Stephen's new girlfriend, about what happened. And she's like, he left to go do the custody swap at 5:45. I stayed at his mom's house 5 or 10 minutes. Then I left. Her story never changes. They can verify where she is. She's not a suspect either. Then they get this call that changes the whole case. It's from somebody that was staying at the hotel behind this Target. Mm-hmm. Where the shooting happened. And they're saying that they saw a white pickup truck with a person in it, and that the person inside the pickup truck they noticed because they looked like they were wearing a fake mustache and a wig. They saw this hours before the shooting. So they're like, thank you, sir. What's your name? My name's Daryl. We want to meet with you. This is the parking lot the dog had sniffed toward. This could be our perp. And he's like, well, all I can say is that I noticed the pickup truck. It's a white pickup truck. It's a really common make and model, but that it had some unusual black trim on it, like black molding that went around the body of the car. And it was added, like this person added the molding. They're not sold this way. So that might be helpful. And they're like, interesting. Well, Stephen's mom does drive a white pickup truck. So they're like, Stephen had access to that car to give it to somebody. Let's go figure out where that car was. And they drive Daryl to the house first, like do drive-bys where they're like, see that? They're like, see this house? Do you recognize any of the cars? And he's like, that's the exact car. And they're like, how do you know though? Again, very common make and model. And he's like, there's that black trim I told you about, and can point it out on the car. Whew. A sketch artist comes in and gets descriptions from the witnesses. It's this person in, if it's a wig, it's kind of a crazy wig, mustache, slim nose. Everyone's saying it's a male. So they go to the mom who owns the truck, and they're like, mm-hmm. where were you? And she's like, well, I left the house well before Stephen left to go do this child thing. I went to my parents, you know, I ran errands. I went to my parents' place. Actually, if you go in my truck, there's a Wendy's receipt in there that proves where I was. And they're like, what was your relationship with Heather like? And she's like, fine. And she can't, like, help herself. She starts to talk shit about Heather and about how she's a bad parent. And there's Jesus not, like, Christ. Heather is dead. Heather's been killed in cold blood. And she's, like, talking
shit. Let's talk shit.
It's really not a good look.
No, especially when they're looking for the murderer.
They confiscate a bunch of guns from her house. And they're like, do you know how to shoot a gun? It's like, no, but I know how to shoot.
No, but I just love collecting them. I just looking at them.
She's like, well, I know how to shoot a revolver. And it's like, that's what they think was used. So there's all these things that are off. And people are talking to the friends again. And they're like, yeah, Joanna didn't like Heather. There was a power play between them for Carson. And like Joanna would do things that pissed off Heather, like walk into the house and pick up Carson and just leave with him, like just take him like he was her kid. And there was tension.
That's a weird move. That is weird.
So what they do
to take a kid that's not yours. That's actually the most fucked up thing I heard this time, to just take a kid. That's fucked.
So what they do is they bring Steven back in and they show Steven the artist's sketch and the surveillance video. And they're like, this is your mom. And he's like, what? And they're like, yeah, it's your mom, isn't it? And there's a little bit of a vibe of, I saw the video of this, and it is sure like they're, you could say in court, and they will, that he was being led. But his reaction, like, his face falls. He starts crying, and he, like,
oh my God.
He's like, she didn't tell me anything. She didn't tell me anything. And they're like, could it be her? And he's like, yeah, it could be, skinny, holy crap. And he's like, oh my God. And they're saying to him, she was trying to take care of you. And he said, that's not taking care of me. And then he's looking at the sketch. He's like, oh, yeah, that could be her nose. And he's like, oh, my God, my son, his life is his life is so screwed up. He has a dead mom and he has, like, basically a murderer grandma. And
yeah,
so he's in the moment very convinced. And you see that. And I don't think you could just convince somebody. I don't know. But
especially if it's his mother, it seems like if someone's goes that easily, it feels like there's something else that you might have been suspicious of.
Sure,
yourself,
like, you know something. Yeah, so they're like, yeah, you should call her, we're gonna try to get her to confess. And he calls her and he's like, mom, I saw the sketch, I saw the video, it's you, it looks just like you. And the mom is like, what do you mean? They're saying it's me. And he's like, it looks just like you, why did you do it? And she's like, I didn't. And he's like, why did you do it, mom? And he's, it's like a 9-minute call and he's crying being like, why did you do this? And she's being like, I didn't. But it becomes very clear to the police in listening to him and watching his behavior. Okay, Steven did not know. Steven did not have anything to do with this. Like, the way he's behaving.
You scared me.
Think, like,
it scared me that sometimes I was like, well, Steven was just trying to convince his mom to take the fall for him. I was like, it could have gone either way. It could have gone, mom,
totally,
why did you, hey, mom,
by
why did you do
him,
this?
They're like, nah. They're like, no, he's not. Steven's not. Nah. And so they bring her in again and she's like, I don't care about their custody. I don't have anything to do with it. It's their business. And they're like, but you knew that there was going to be an exchange that day. And she's like, no. And it's like, yes, you did. And then she's, again, this fucking woman, she cannot help herself talking shit about Heather and being like, well, and one time there was jewelry that went missing and I think Heather stole it. And they're like, okay, just so you know, it's really hard to hide if you're a killer. We're going to, like, find stuff on your car. And they've, you know, taken her car. And she's like, I don't care. I don't care. Do it then. Do it. She's, like, playing chicken with them. And she's like, when you find the blood or whatever it is you're looking for, then you call me. And she basically, like, walks out of the room. She's like, I'm out. They show the witnesses Joanna's photo, and it's not very helpful. Like, frankly, some of them are like, yeah, it could be her. And some of them are like, I don't know. It's not
a weird wig and a mustache. Yeah.
Yeah. They do remove a single fiber from the floorboard of her car that is a fiber that they're like, this likely came from a wig. That's not great, but it's something.
Yeah, you're not looking for it's likely it came from a wig. You're like, this is from a wig.
That's
all
they find is likely. Like, they find stuff in the car that could be gunshot residue. They just can't nail her down, so it's taking a long time. They don't want to go to trial because they're like, look, if we fuck this up, that's it. So basically for 6 months they're trying to find anything, but the evidence isn't helping. It just keeps being circumstantial at best. But they bring it to the grand jury and they're like, yes, you have a case. She gets arrested, she lawyers up. The bullet fragments that are removed from Heather's body match a .38 revolver. They cannot find this gun, but they talk to Joanna's ex, and he's like, when we were breaking up, she pulled a .38 revolver and put it to my head in a fight. I know she owns one, and I think I'm here by the grace of God. Like, that woman almost killed me. So that's helpful.
So that's helpful.
A coworker of Joanna's? I mean, it's like they just don't have anything. But then a coworker of Joanna's comes forward and is like, you know, it was really weird. One day we were killing time at work, me and Joanna, and she started talking about how she would commit a murder, that she would destroy the weapon, that she would drive her Ford because there's so many of them. She wouldn't drive these other cars she owned, that she would have a disguise, that she would get rid of the disguise and the clothes she wore that day in different places. And so they bring him in too. But during the trial, when they call Steven, he has since obviously spoken to his mom. And he's scared out of his mind. Or maybe he's just like, I lost Heather. I need help. Like, if I'm going to have Carson, like, I'm going to need help. I need my mom. So whatever has happened, he's not the same man crying in an interrogation room anymore. He's definitely, like, not going to say anything. But they are able to play the audio of the call in court. And people in court are able to hear him crying, saying, "Mom, it looks just like you. Why'd you do it?" And, like, he seems highly convinced in that call. Joanna's stone still, not making any facial expressions in court, giving nothing, doesn't testify. And the defense is like, "Look, you didn't prove it. All of this is circumstantial." The jury deliberates for 2 weeks. The only question they ask during deliberation is that they want to rehear the call, the Stephen mom call. They're out 3 days, but they do come back with a verdict of guilty, that Joanna is guilty.
That's crazy based on circumstances. That is crazy.
It just shows you it can all, we think we know how these things go. We have an idea in our minds of how they should or do go, and it can be anything. She is sentenced to life in prison with a chance of parole in 30 years. And, you know, Dateline sort of ended on a note of, like, talking to Michael, who had this really sweet relationship with Heather and ends up seeming like a really sweet guy when we decide he's not a killer. And him sort of wondering, like, what life might have been, like, this could have been a family, you know, him and Heather and Carson. And I think that he's mourning that.
Stephen's mother killed her. That's fucked. That's for fucked. Custody.
Like, it's so bad. And speaking of custody, obviously, Carson goes to Heather's parents, but her mom dies, like, just 3 years later. Her dad Buddy becomes, like, this single grandpa dad of Carson. It's so sad. He doesn't really have a lot of contact with Stephen at all. I don't think he was a great guy, by the way, but he's also, like, definitely one of Joanna's victims in all this, and she seems truly evil to not only have done this, but, like, to be like, I love Carson so much, I'm going to do this. You're going to kill Carson's mom in front of him? Like, what?
That's fucked up.
I was just so surprised that it was her. Like, in listening to it, I was like, this mom did it?
That's some, like, mommy issues. Like, I can't imagine Steven being normal if that's what his mom does. Like, could you imagine if you were a teacher and you gave Steven a bad grade and that woman came to your fucking office? Pass. You know what I mean? Pass. She was fucking insane. The Quinn Posner of mothers, you know?
Oh my God, stop. I just, like...
Would you kill?
But here's the thing: I think everybody's life. She ruined everybody's life. Like,
and Quinn,
it's really
take
crazy.
That as a lesson. Take that as a lesson. You can't murder Fakoa.
Any more murders?
You can't do any more murders of the Blue Jacket kid. You can't do it. Rip his arms out.
Anyway, that's the story. Very sad.
Really
sad. Dateline does a great job. I love Dateline. Can I give a shout out to Dateline?
Hey, Dateline. Do you think they look at free advertising from us? Do you think they need it?
Yeah, this, you guys, I got it from this Chinese startup.
It's a tiny startup, Dateline. Have you heard of it? You heard of it?
Let's go out and give them some support. Join their Patreon before they close their doors forever. Like, oy.
They've been around for only, 30 plus years?
Do you think if I say it enough, they'll turn around and say it back about us?
Oh, that would be great. That would be really nice. I would love that. Hey, guys, love that. We love you, Dateline. I'm going to go.
All right. I'm starving. Yeah, let's go.
Okay. Hey, bye, dearest readers. Like, review, subscribe, tinkle, dance like no one's watching. I don't know. Okay. Go to the bathroom. Go pee when you have to go pee. We don't want any UTIs here.
Whatever you do, don't meditate.
You heard it here first. Goodbye.
Your child has so much potential, but your local schools may not be right for them. Check out K-12. K-12 powered schools are accredited tuition-free online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who have chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more. That's k12.com/podcast.